Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to LSE for this Women in Business discussion hosted by LSE's Department of Management. My name is Sarah Ashwin and I'm a Professor of Comparative Employment Relations in the Department of Management at London School of Economics. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon to welcome Professor Benjamin Boyer and Alison Zimmerman. Ben is L'Oréal Professor of Creativity Marketing and Professor of Marketing at ESCP Europe and Visiting Fellow here at the LSE. Since studying at the Sorbonne, HSC Paris, and indeed the LSE, where he received both his master's and his doctorate, Ben has gone on to author over 150 scientific contributions. I'm very envious of that, I've got to say, and publish in leading psychology journals. His research investigates how self-perception and interpersonal relations affect behaviours, which is particularly significant when considering the psychology of powers within the framework of organisations. We very much look forward to what Ben will have to say. Our second speaker is Alison Zimmerman, who we welcome to the LSE stage for a second time. Thank you for that, Alison. Alison, as many of you will know, is Executive Director of Catalyst Europe. She is an advocate for women on boards, for reducing the gender pay gap, and for women in leadership. She also has a successful track record of advising global organisations on their diversity and inclusion initiatives, creating real and positive change for women at work. And it's a fantastic thing to do. So this afternoon, Ben and Alison will speak about power and how power differentials in the workplace can be so dangerous. Harassment and abuse within organisations, and notably by the people with power within these organisations, is not new. There have been some well-publicised episodes in the past. For example, some of you may remember the 2004 episode with Dov Charney, the founder of American Apparel Retail Stores. At the time, we thought, or many people thought, that these were just isolated episodes. But the flood of allegations unleashed by Me Too and Time's Up suggests the problem is not merely episodic, it is systemic. We hope that this afternoon's discussion can help address the misuse of power in workplaces where men and women come together to earn a living. Now, before I invite Ben and Alison to speak, I will say a few words on the format of the event. Ben and Alison will speak for around 20 minutes each, and as usual, you will have an opportunity to ask some questions. For those of you who wish to take the discussion online, the Twitter hashtag is @LSEWomenIn, but I would ask all of you to please put your phones on silent to avoid disrupting the event. This afternoon's event is being recorded and will be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. I'll put in that proviso. Before I just invite the speakers to speak, the fire exit is there, and stewards very experienced will guide you should that event occur, but we very much hope it won't. So now will you please join me in welcoming Professor Ben Boyer and Alison Zimmerman to deliver their lecture, Power at Play, Tackling Harassment in the Workplace. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you to the LSE Women in Business Society as well for putting this great event. As Sarah mentioned, my research is around self-perception. And in today's talk, I want to tell you a bit more about how power affects self-perception. And doing so, what I'm really interested in doing is to give you a bigger picture about what power is and what power does. And in a way, I'm going to address the following question, which is, how does power affect self-perception, emotions, and behaviors? And understanding how power acts from a psychological point of view will help us to better define and understand the consequences of power in the topic of today, which is workplace harassment. I'll start with a definition of power, then I'll give you a bit of more information about power and the way we process information, the way we experience emotions, the way we behave, and then I have some concluding thoughts that hopefully will tie in nicely with Alison's talk about how we can address the negative consequences of power. But let's start with power first and defining power. Power matters, that's for sure, and that's something that psychologists and going beyond that social scientists know a lot about. Russell, 1938, says that the fundamental concept in social science is power, in the same sense that energy is the fundamental concept in physics. Power is seen as a key component of social interaction that is pervasive, is in most social interaction, according to Susan Fisker. And power is really seen as something that is essential for individuals to understand and organize their relationship. So really, power is something that is ingrained in our everyday life. So how do psychologists look at power, and how do psychologists define power? There's two traditional definitions, and I'll invite you to reflect how these definitions can play in the workplace. First of all, power is seen as a potentiality to exert influence and stay an influence. And influence can come in multiple ways, as I'll say in a minute. And the second traditional definition of power is the capacity to control one's own and others' resources and outcome. And to put these definitions in light, I will draw back on the work of French and Raven. Quite old work, almost 60 years ago, French and Raven ask a very important question, which is, in a way, why do we comply to powerful people? And they identified five bases for power. The first one is coercion. That is, we comply to powerful people because they can punish us if we do not comply to their behaviors. The other side of the tale is that we comply because they can offer us rewards. They can be financial rewards, they can be other forms of rewards. Then French and Raven look at expertise as a form of power. We might comply to powerful people because they have knowledge, they have expertise that justify us to behave in a certain way. If you're new in an organization, if there is an expert in the organization, the knowledge that that person has, no matter whether that person has a functional link to yours and a kind of status hierarchical link to yours, means that the knowledge, the expertise they have is enough to constitute the basis of power. Then come legitimacy. Legitimacy as a source of power is whatever warrants someone to, in a way, give orders to another person. This is typical of the power we see in organization. If the person is one level above you or two levels above you asks you to do something, you're going to comply on the basis of the legitimacy that this person has to give such orders. The last one, the last basis for power that I found very interesting from French and Raven is called referent power. Here, we're not talking about formal relationship in which power takes place, but we're talking about someone that you might want to be like, you might want to resemble, that is a role model, and that person will exert power and influence on the basis that you admire that person. This is, again, a form of power that has been involved in multiple cases of harassment in the workplace. So I want to move from our understanding of power as a capacity to influence, stay in influence, and control over resources to now look into three key areas that matters for psychologists. How we process information, we call it cognition. How we experience emotions, that's emotion, self-explanatory. And finally, how we behave. First of all, thinking about power and the way it affects information processing. Typically, as I've just said, we define power and we understand power as the capacity to stay in influence or influence. And indeed, if we look at the work of Adam Galinsky, for instance, he did a study in which he asked participants to create new names. And what he did in his study, he used what we call in psychology a prime. That's a little task that makes you feel a different way. And he primed people to feel powerful or to feel powerless. And then what he found is that the people that were primed to feel powerful were less likely to be influenced by benchmark of names that were showcased in his study. In a similar vein, Brinol and colleagues found that when people take a powerful social role, for instance, they play a role play, in a role play, they endorse the role of a boss versus an employee, that tends to reinforce their confidence in their individual beliefs. They're more likely to think they're right, in a nutshell. Anna Guinot, who studies the cognitive consequences of power, that is, the consequences of power on how we process information, shows that, and it's quite interesting because power also has positive effects, and that's one of them, powerful individuals are less distracted by peripheral information, by not so essential information, and they tend to focus on core information. Anderson and Ganinsky looked at people in power and said that people in power exert traits such as being self-confident and more focused on their internal emotions. Now, one of the key things that actually matters when it comes to power, and it will be, I think, something that resonates with Alison's talk, is power affects our capacity to step into the shoes of the other. That's something in psychology that we call perspective taking. And here, there's nothing better than a classic study by, again, Galinsky, that looks at how power affects the perspective taking capacity of subjects. He did a very clever experiment in which he used, again, a power prime, so a little task in which he made people feel more or less powerful. And then he was asking participants to draw a letter on their forehead. And what he looked at is whether people were taking the perspective of the other, that is, writing a letter that is readable from the other party, or whether people were sticking to their own perspective, that is, write a letter from their point of view that is not readable by the partner in the study. And what Galinsky and colleagues found in 2006 in a psychological science paper was that people that were primed with power were less likely to take the perspective of the other in a very physical way, because they were more likely to draw a letter that only them could actually read. And there's further evidence and further emerging work that is very interesting about the way power affects even the way how our brain function. For instance, you can look into the work of Keltner, who's an American psychologist, that looks and argues that the effect of power on the brain is similar to what he calls a mini-trauma. So you experience similarities between the brains of powerful people and the brains of people that have suffered injuries in the frontal lobe part of the brain. Digging a bit more on this work on information processing, to get to the big picture, I think, you know, why I wanted to start with this work is to have a kind of a clinical take on power and what it does to the way our mind works. Goodwin and colleagues, for instance, their work suggests that individuals that are high in dominance or power tend to use more stereotype. They're more likely to go into stereotyping, to rely on that type of information, when people that have less power are more likely to try and engage in true impression formation. In other words, they are more likely to try and understand who you really are, when people in power tend to stereotype who you are. Using stereotypes is often something that is seen among powerful people. And by the way, stereotypes is something that is something that can be perceived as in most cases, as negative, and in some cases can even be insulting. Looking at the work of Grinfeld, very interesting, but she finds in her research, she finds that power tends to increase objectification of others. We tend to see more people as a mean to an end when we are in power than when we are not in power. And finally, in some work I conducted with Tom Reeder, also from the London School of Economics, what we find is that status and power tend to produce a view of yourself that isolates you from the rest of your surroundings. So that's what we call the independent self. And when you become in power, your independent self becomes heightened, and you tend to feel more unique, more different from others. There is something else that goes on, which is that there's an interesting gender difference that goes on here when you think about the effect of power on self-perception. Now, it might sound a bit contradictory, but we have both a sense of the self as independent from others and interdependent from others. And they are you know, one is not the opposite of the other. You can feel very unique, but very connected to others. In other words, you can feel very independent and very interdependent. Now, in our research, what we find is that power raises the level of independence of men and lowers their sense of interdependence. In other words, men feel more unique and different and less connected. When we look at the effect of power on women, women do show that same effect, that they feel more unique and different from others, that it raises their feeling of independence. But surprisingly, interdependence goes the other way compared with men. So they also feel more connected. And there's a lot of literature that sadly goes beyond this short lecture on gender differences in leadership style that tend to show that women tend to adopt a much more democratic leadership style compared to men that tend to adopt a more autocratic leadership style. Democratic and autocratic here refers to the inclusion of others in taking decisions. Now, moving on and discussing the role of power in terms of emotions. A lot of research here. So Kaltner and Ebenbach, for instance, showed that university students in fraternities that are in a lower position within their fraternity tend to be much better at reading emotions of the more higher-powered members in that organization. Similarly, powerful people have been shown to be able to display more emotional contagion when they behave compared with people that have less power. Hecht and LaFrance show that individuals with power tend to only smile when they actually experience positive emotion rather than faking smiles. So in other words, people in power are more true to the emotions that they experience. Similar work shows that powerful individuals in a way tend to also simply experience more positive emotion and fewer negative ones. And they're more also likely to express their true attitudes. And finally, it's related to the first work I mentioned today. Powerful individuals tend to pay less attention to the emotions of the other side. So you do see that from a psychological point of view, power is something that isolates you. It isolates you from taking the perspective of the other. It isolates you from reading emotions from the other. And that's something that's been really well documented, not just in the work I'm showcasing today, but in work that goes beyond that. And now let's focus on behaviors, because at the end of the day, when we're talking about harassment in the workplace, what matters is the behavior of certain individuals. Now, Yalinsky, again, one of the authority scholars on power, argues that power creates an action orientation from power holders. That is, people are more ready to act upon thinking upon many of the things that might go in their mind. Can be positive, obviously can be negative. Further work suggests that actually people that tend to have power tend to be more proactive. So that's kind of, you know, some concrete example behind the action orientation that Galinsky discusses in his work. For instance, if you look at negotiation, powerful people tend to be first movers. So they tend to be the one that make the first offer, which can be an advantage in some circumstances when you're doing negotiation, as the literature on the topic suggests. Again, a correlate of what we've discussed before, but people that have power are less likely to donate to suffering individuals than individuals that have low power, as shown in Xenke and Free's research about 10 years ago. Again, you can see that there is a sequence here. Power changes the way you process information. Power changes the way you experience emotion. As a result of this, because you're not connecting with the people that are in a low power position, you're actually less likely to behave in a way that can benefit them. And it doesn't start, you know, you don't need to wait until being an adult to actually witness this kind of behaviors. For instance, in the work of Lippitt, he showed that he did a field study with children at within, you know, school age, and he found that boys with more power are more likely to try and influence other people in their classes. Generally speaking, a lot of research suggests that power tends to lead to unsocial behaviors or making you more likely to engage in socially unacceptable behavior, like rude behaviors and so on. You can check, for instance, the work of Brown and Levinson, who said that a lot of the behaviors that can be considered rude, for instance, eating with your mouth open and so on, are more likely to be done by people that are in a high status condition. And just to transition to really to today's topic in terms of what power does to the way we think and we behave, the work of John Barg, American psychologist John Barg, is very interesting in that respect. He showed in the mid-90s, that paper is, I think is 1995, that power is related to an increase in making automatic association with sexual thoughts. Here, just to be quite clear, he worked in experiments where he was measuring how people would react and would respond to various stimulus. And there were ambiguous stimulus that implied or had sexual connotation. What he found is there were two clear results. People that were in his studies, and they were men in his studies, were more likely to make automatic association between power concept and sexual ones. They were also more likely to find a target female that was presented as attractive when they were primed with power. So there is a connection between this, but what is very important is what I've highlighted here. It's only for men that are high in likelihood to sexually harass. What it means is that power exacerbates an existing trait or tendency. It's not something that automatically would lead to this behavior, but it's something that if you've got a trait that is naturally there, like natural tendency to engage in harassing behaviors, then power can be the catalyst, power can be the trigger. So where do we go from there? Well, there's a few things and areas that can be explored, and this should tie in nicely with Alison's talk. First of all, making people that are in power aware of the consequences of power. Often, people are not aware of this. They're not aware of this because, as we've seen in this lecture, there is a disconnection that is being created by power. So making those in power more aware of the consequences of power, not as a way to kind of lecture them in a formal way, but as a way to say, look, these are the extent of the literature, this is the extent of what we know power does to yourself, is something that I would explore. Considering the psychological consequences of power when hiring or promoting. Not enough, this is not done enough. A lot of the time, you hire someone not thinking about what that person in a powerful position will be like. And the work that I do on power and self-perception suggests that when you put someone in a powerful position, this can create a shift in the way they perceive themselves in relation to others. Very, very rarely being taken into consideration. Last but not least, perspective-taking exercises. As I've discussed in this lecture, there are clear consequences of power on our capacity to take or not take the perspective of the other. And yet what we see is a lot of the time people that engage in harassment in the workplace are not aware of the consequences. They lack, you know, the capacity to actually step into the shoes of the other, empathize, cum patere, suffer with in Latin, and so they lack this capacity. So designing exercise that allows people to take the perspective of the other, which is something, by the way, which there's a revolution about to take place with virtual reality. With virtual reality, you can actually immerse people in the shoes of the other. A lot of colleagues actually in the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science do this kind of research on what we call Cyranoid effect. What happens if you see the world through the eyes of the other? And for some, it can be a big breakthrough. On this note, I'm now glad to welcome Alison, who will tell us about her perspective on power. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Ben. Thank you so much, Ben. So, as Ben said, Alison Zimmerman, Executive Director of Catalyst Europe, will now speak. Thank you, Alison.
Yeah, and I'm just, I'm not the most tech savvy, so can somebody switch the slides? Ah, perfect. It was that easy. I should say, on other people's computers, I'm not the most tech savvy. Thank you for having me. I'm not sure how many have heard of Catalyst. Has anybody before today? Don't worry. Oh, yeah, okay. Some people I know in the audience, so thank you for raising. Catalyst has been around since 1962. I have to stand close to the microphone. So What we've been looking a lot recently, especially at sexual harassment. This is top of mind, not only because of Time's Up and Me Too, but it's because this is what companies are talking about as well. We work with over 800 multinational corporations globally, and much of our research is global. However, we do a little bit of deep dives into some geographies. For example, in our inclusive leadership research, we looked into Germany because it is a country that we get a lot of questions about. And so from that scope, the research we've done recently is more of a review of literature out there. We are actively building our research at the moment. So the recommendations that we will suggest is based on what we see is working out there and what isn't, but also what we see is missing. And today, now I'm talking about sexual harassment on this slide. I'm just going to put up a lot of quotes. We know, due to Time's Up and Me Too, this is a topic that is top of mind. It is not going away, we hope. We hope that there has been a shift in the consciousness that this is happening and this is real. When we go to the Q&A, happy to share some stories about recently, I won't say the country, but I was in one country I've never been to a week ago, and I had a leader tell a group of women after we did another exercise that Ben, I'll mention briefly, that the women were sharing their experience. And what we saw in this one example, and not to pick on the leader, but the leader said to the group, "I don't believe you." To the women who walked across the room. And what we asked is we did an exercise called the other exercise, where we want people to feel the experience of what it's like to be different, whatever dimension of diversity you bring to the table. And it may be you're an introvert. So we would say, please walk to the other side of the room if you're an introvert. And what happens, why we do this exercise, is exactly to Ben's point about empathy. It's about taking the perspective of another. And when we do this, there's rarely a time where, most of the time, everybody walks. In the question that took the perspective of sexual harassment as real, is I asked the question, please walk across the room if you ever feel unsafe, either working late at night or going on a business trip. And we have been seeing, whenever we ask a question around sexual harassment and women in these experiential exercises, all the women walk. Sometimes one woman out of maybe 30 women in the room won't walk. And we've known in the last 2 years there's something happening that we are not hearing. So when Me Too and Time's Up happened, we went, that's what we're picking on. It's extremely powerful when we do this exercise, especially for men, that they see, and men, by the way, experience sexual harassment too. We know this. So no way in any way are we making this about men or women. They all experience it in different ways and forms. But what we saw across the globe, not only in Europe, is every time we do it, it's primarily women who walk, and maybe 3 or 4 men out of a group of 70. And what that tells is not to depress, but to realize that just because we're not talking about it doesn't mean it's not happening. And so today with the discussion, power matters, taking Ben's comment. Leaders have a lot of influence in how to accelerate change. In the example that I shared with the walk across the room, there was a leader who said, I don't believe that this is happening, but saw all the women walk. It was really telling because he suddenly, even though he saw it, he had to hear and see it. And so we don't want to belabor that point, but to realize that corporations know that they can lead change, especially in this time and age where we often look to governments or we look to other organizations, but corporations primarily can say, this is not okay. And recently, I was speaking with a company, and it was, I'll just say, a law firm. It is a law firm, but I won't say what region. And we talked about non-disclosures. We talked about this. And they said, we are reopening cases at the moment that have been on sexual harassment that we pardoned. We basically kept the partner who was accused by a number of women. So maybe this was, I'll just throw a year. This wasn't the actual year, 8 years ago or whatever. They're reopening it. So even if that partner was kept, as a law firm, they're saying, not good enough. Maybe we did that, well, not anymore. And they're investigating this. This is not an isolated incident. And so there's a lot of fear when you bring up the subject of sexual harassment. There's a lot of gray zone around this. But today, I want to talk about power and the dynamics and how we can create change and how leaders and employers can really be the ones to say, this, we need to stop, whether it's sexual harassment, incivil behavior, bullying, all of that is encompassing what we mean by harassment. And so, just going to go to the next. So we gave, and I'm happy to share this with anybody who wants to see it, there's a whole tool on this, and I'll go through individually each one. But we, based on our literature review, we discovered there were four actions. And I'll go through individually rather quickly those actions. And what we found, let me see, prepare is the first one. And what we mean by this is it's not necessarily going and having trainings, although trainings can be helpful. It's not going to solve the problem. We have to go beyond the training. But really preparing to really investigate what policies we have in place, what's the due course, and how is this communicated, and putting that time there. It also means developing an impartial investigative process. So just because somebody brings up something, we need an impartial process there, and we need an open door policy with management that those who are accusing have a safe place to go without breaking any confidentiality, without getting the pushback. Because what we know, primarily women in particular, end up, when they report, often leaving organizations because it wasn't handled properly. And so this is an important part, but it's not the end part. Prevent. And by the way, if you want to share the slides, feel free, LSE, so you don't have to like scribble or anything. There are different ways. When we talk about prevention, we really want to create a zero tolerance policy. And it means being crystal clear about your policies. If there is a gray zone, talk about it. So Google, this is public, they didn't tell us this, but Google has a policy that if you ask somebody on a date, you can only ask one time. And if they say no, you cannot go back and go, hey, remember I asked you, remember? Because it takes out this kind of gray zone. Actually, I can ask on a date, but I'm not, it's up to her or him. It could be a woman always asking to a man. It's up to the person that I've asked to come back and instigate the conversation further. But the one ask is the one ask. And you know, every company has a different culture. And every culture has a different culture. So it's really what companies are doing is spending a lot of time dialoguing. What does this mean for our culture in our context? What is our challenge? And really looking at that and being clear. And you'll see here we talk about the different types, the different levels, patronizing, taunting, and predatory, and recognizing that there is also different levels of that. And then respond. What we mean is take accusations seriously. Recently, I was in a meeting. I won't say the country. I was with the CEO and the global head of HR. And we were brought in to be a thought, you know, a leader on a challenge they were having on gender equality in the workplace. We were not there to talk about sexual harassment. But during the meeting, the global HR said to the CEO, we have a case. And we have a case where one of your executives of the top, you know, group has been accused of sexual harassment. The CEO, I got along very well with, turned to me and said, hey, it's not true. You know, it's not true. And I looked at him. Mind you, he heard in the moment, the same moment I heard, that they have a case. And I said, how do you know? Why is the burden of proof instantly first put that it's not, you're saying it's not true? And the way his response was, and so I turned to HR and I said, who came forward? Was it a man or was it a woman? And he said, a man. And the CEO looked and he went, oh, so it's also this stereotype that we have. But his instinct was it's not true. And challenging power and recognizing maybe it is true. Maybe we should start with let's investigate, let's look at it, and not have a default setting based on stories or things we see or our own beliefs. Let's get an impartial group. What happened in this incident is a manager came forward on behalf of three women being sexually harassed. The women were not coming forward because they did not want the retaliation. The fear to come forward means that you suddenly have a spotlight on you. And the same for men. Imagine a man coming forward of sexual harassment. It's a whole different dilemma and whole different challenge, whole different navigation of what it means. And now put in race and ethnicity. It's even more difficult to come forward of a different race, ethnicity. So we work with corporations for them to see that the workplace is being experienced quite differently by the different dimensions of diversity, but also what we see in the media, what we think may be the problem or not the problem. In that case, when the head of HR said, it's a man on behalf of three women, and he has had enough. And he's been witnessing it and seeing it, and he spoke out. This is what we call bystander intervention. It's one of the most powerful interventions. It goes to taking the perspective of another and stepping in the shoes and taking action. And I'll come back to that when we come to another. And transform. Ultimately, when we did our literature review, we found there were some things missing from the recommendations. One of them was empathy, which Ben talked about. And the other, it was really about creating, going beyond the training, but creating a culture of dialogue. And this will come to a further slide. But understanding that transforming the culture can be really powerful in giving a voice to the people who've experienced it, but also ensuring it doesn't happen again. And we say build a culture of respect and accountability. And fascinating, I had no idea that alcohol was a common theme in many sexual harassment cases. Our point of view is it's not an excuse. It might be a theme, it's not an excuse. So one thing that, so you hear an American accent, I'm actually Swiss and American, so I work primarily in Europe. So I didn't fly over from the U.S. for this, but what we have seen in the U.S. when we've spoken with CEOs and leaders is that they are now putting in a two-drink, I keep saying minimum, a two-drink maximum. I know, I said it at a board meeting recently, and they have not let me forget. I think our two-drink minimum might be in Europe. I don't know, at least with Catalyst. But just teasing. But the two-drink maximum are what many U.S. headquarter companies are doing. There is one company, I cannot verify this because I don't know this executive, and I heard it from a CEO who was in this discussion, said that they have put a moratorium on having men and women gather in private meetings, meaning no more private meetings, which is ridiculous. Because let's go back to power. How do we share power? Power is transferred often through sponsorship, through a male or a female manager advocating for another. But if you're afraid to engage with a male or a female for perceptions of how it will be, power, that's a huge opportunity and loss of power that can be shared. And so, how can we accelerate change? What we know is that when power is shared across gender, harassment levels go down. So our point of view is training and reporting is not enough. It's really about looking at the inequality of power in the workplace and seeing that as we increase more women into more of the senior leadership roles, we will see more equity in power. A senior woman shared with me recently, she said she was from Norway, that's not where her company is, but she said, you know, she heard, you know, about some of the discussions, and she's speaking to a leadership group on this topic this week. And she reached out to me. She said, you know, I could tell you stories. I could tell you, she said. But you know, it's really interesting. As I get more senior in the organization, I really don't receive this anymore. And she goes, maybe I'm older. Maybe it's that. But in the beginning. And I said to her, which we always say when we talk about power, is privilege is invisible to those who have it. We don't see your privilege if we're in a place of power. And that might bring home some other points that were brought. So we know that while having women in leadership may, and it will not inoculate a company's bad behavior or leaders of the company, it could reflect a more inclusive workplace so that we see female leadership as colleagues, peers, leaders, but not necessarily prey. And that's where we really want to go, is increase more equality in all levels. And sexual harassment can happen at all levels. We're not saying it's at the top. And we're not only talking about sexual harassment, bullying, different behaviors that are incivil. So how can we change? I'm going to keep this brief because we're going to have a Q&A. But this is something to think about. And if you get the slides, I really encourage you to consider these questions and discuss. But basically, what we know with building an inclusive culture is really looking at the behaviors that create inclusion, that make people feel like they belong. When we talk about, obviously many of these I talk take discrimination claims seriously, create an environment where it's safe to disclose. And one thing that we really highlight in inclusive culture is bringing in other behaviors that will make people feel included. And empowerment, we call it the each mindset, empowerment, accountability, courage, and humility. Really, really selfless behaviors, altruistic behaviors, are what we're seeing leaders need to display to create even a more safe space for people to share. Engage men. This is probably the bulk of the work we've been doing in the last year. Is men are not the problem, they're a part of the solution. It's really engaging them to see that they play a powerful role. And in the bystander intervention, they can play an incredible role because we know that certain types of harassment are happening more towards women. And so with power, I'll give an example of one leader and then go to the last. One leader openly was at an event, and one of his team, not his direct report, he was a country leader. So it was somebody farther down in the management, and he watched. He saw him with a client, a female client. And he could tell he was about a drink away and 10 minutes away from crossing the line. And he was observing, and he went, ordered a cab, told the guy, hey, I need to talk with you, got him up out of the room of the what was more of an outside event, like cocktail event, got him out outside of the restaurant and said to him, I need to tell you that you're getting really dangerously close to crossing the line, and I've ordered a cab. Thank you. go home. We'll talk about this the next day. But I want you to know that I am doing this to save you from making this next step. So what happened, next day, this country leader called the direct manager and said, I need to share what happened. This is what happened, and I'm happy to have a discussion with him. He did not cross the line, but he got very close. This is an example of bystander intervention that we talk about. It's also what companies are talking about, of not only accountability of the individual, but the group. And then finally, engaging in real dialogue. And, you know, it's a dialogue, not a debate. Most companies are going to really discuss what does this, they want to have these discussions, maybe around the gray zone. But they're doing it in really safe, small groups to get people to feel safe and secure. All our actions matter. It is definitely leaders and employers play a real role. But we know that power has to be shared. And power, the more that we see certain groups, not only women, be able to have power, the more we will see some behaviors diminish. So on that note, I'd like to stop and pass it over. I hope I didn't go too far over my time. Okay.
Thank you so much, Ben and Alison, for your fascinating insights. I think that those presentations complemented each other absolutely beautifully. We had the theory and we had an application, and they just went very well together, and you were also perfect timekeepers, both of you. Thank you very, very much. So we'll now open the floor to questions from the audience. Please let us know your name and affiliation and wait for the roving microphone to reach you before you ask your questions. So over to you. Yes, thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Hoff. I'm from Skanska. I'm head of people for one of our construction projects. So how does a company evaluate the extent of the problem in the workplace with harassment with men or women if people don't come forward?
I think what they're doing initially, and this is still, it's not early days. I mean, we know training and this issue has been going on forever, but I think it was tolerated. And so what I'm discovering, I know Skanska's in Sweden, you're in the UK too, definitely, but you're all over. What we're discovering is that there's how people are coming forward, but they're being taken more seriously. And how to encourage them to come forward is walk the talk. If you're saying this is zero tolerance, but you discuss what does this mean, and you're not afraid to have an open discussion, people will start to trust that, hey, this happened. There was one case, I will just say Northern Europe, not necessarily the same country, where it was very clear. So somebody did come forward, a woman, and there was another culture involved. And what happened is it opened up a huge discussion in the organization. Definitely with HR and leadership, maybe not the broader aren't aware of it, but it's opening a discussion on how do we handle this, and maybe we need to explain the guardrails about what is appropriate and not appropriate. And some people will say, well, that you know, we did this, you know, for decades. It's not clear, and especially when you bring in other cultures, you have the policies, but you often don't have the definitions, especially in that gray area. So encouraging dialogue will hopefully set the stage that people will feel more comfortable coming forward. The chilling effect is our biggest concern right now, is that women will not be mentored and will not be sponsored because men will be afraid. Oh, what will they, you know, the pendulum swung so far over here, I'm going to lose my job. And so really demonstrating that leaders, role modeling, that they're not going to stop sponsoring women. And sponsorship just means advocating. It means you're going out, and you might go out and have lunch, get to know your sponsee better. Mentoring is different. Mentoring is about development. But sponsoring means those people being sponsored have made it to that level that they deserve to have somebody advocating on their behalf. I don't know if you have anything to add, Ben.
No, I think it's absolutely spot on. I would say from a research point of view, what's important is that we focus so much on people explicitly going forward about, you know, harassment. Mm. But they are weak signal. They are early things that can be detected. If you look at the literature, there will be things that tells you that, and I'm not making it specific about sexual harassment, but bullying, which is also a big topic, especially in the UK, you can detect bullying by looking at subtle changes of behaviors. And for me, it would be about, I don't know if it's been done, but it would be about, very academic answer, sorry, starting with a review of the literature of what are these signs that, yeah, you know, can indicate that someone is being in a position of sexual harassment, or, again, you made it clear that it's not just about, mm-hmm, you know, it's the bigger picture, and then training people to notice these signs. I think, you know, telling people that, you know, if you notice this and this and this, you know, the same way, for instance, people that work on suicide prevention are, you know, trained to look at people's wrists to see if there is any evidence of self-damage, and maybe asking a question not obviously about suicide, but about, you know, is everything okay? Like, just, you know, there's ways of guiding it, and we can use the best practices in other, you know, that people work for other causes to that. But I think that could be really helpful as well.
Don't be shy. Yes.
The LSE Business Review. I was interested in the example you gave at Google. One, you ask them out once. So it is okay to have a relationship at work. And so that creates, it's a real fine line. And how do you know you're not crossing the line?
I don't want to stereotype, but we spend most of our day in the workplace. Most relationships, many happen in the workplace. So I think this strict rule and this coming in and taking too strict of a position can have the opposite. But I really liked what Ben was saying, that if there are some traits, how did you say it? If there are some traits that are already there, they're more likely to show these other traits, such as sexual harassment. We found that, too, in the literature review, that if you go through training, for example, it doesn't mean, like, the training. If you have somebody who is really, like, this is stupid, this is not worth it, whatever, there's research that shows they're actually more likely to, it's not, they're more likely to go in that line of behavior. So it's just, I think as a company, from a corporate point of view, it's really important that they, however they define this gray zone, whether it means dating, you know, with internally, that they define it, that they say, you know, this is what is expected. Very simple example, GM, the CEO, Mary Barra, she, it wasn't sexual harassment, but they had 12 pages of policy for how to dress in the workplace. And she went, can we just get rid of this? Two words, dress appropriately. Boom. The problem with sexual harassment, and by the way, their policy is two words. And so you go to a client meeting, is it appropriate? You know, the problem with sexual harassment, one of our board members highlighted this, is that one person said, well, isn't this just good behavior you learn at home? And a board member said, not everybody has the same home and the same lessons. So defining it and being clear and talking about it, having courageous conversations, that is where a lot of companies are going, because they're figuring it out along with everybody else. This topic has been around for a long time, but it has not been handled appropriately for a long time. So they're having to look at it in a more authentic way.
No, absolutely. I mean, generally speaking, in psychology, we make a distinction between influence and persuasion. Persuasion, we're trying to change the core beliefs that people have. we're trying to change the attitude. Influence, we're focusing on the outcome, which is the behavior. And as much as psychologists would love to see attitudes and behavior correlated, unfortunately, they're weakly correlated. That is to say, and jumping back on Alison's point, is that sometimes you won't change or you can't change the attitudes. Sometimes a persuasion attempt, an attempt to change people's belief, will fire back.
And I think this is, you know, what?
Unconscious bias.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All reactants and a lot of non-phenomenon. So sometimes you're just better off focusing on influence. That is, trying to change directly the behavior. You can change the behavior by designing a safer environment. That is, you know, you're not relying on changing the attitudes. Sadly, because, you know, we would, I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that we should not aim at changing the attitudes. But what I'm saying is that if in some cases it's a lost battle or it's draining too many resources, then you'd rather focus on changing the behaviors by influencing and designing a safer workplace.
And just to add to that, there is a great book years ago called Switch, where they look at how change happens. And it's not that you see, you know, you think and analyze and change happens, like, okay, now I'm going to do this. But people have to see it and feel it. So especially in a corporate, when they hear a message saying, not good enough, or this isn't right, and they see the ramifications, particularly of a star harasser, somebody who's been maybe tolerated a behavior, whether it's bullying, and has gotten away with that behavior because of their success. It's not that companies are making an example, but they're also looking to say, you know what, this isn't okay. And they're not afraid to cut that star harasser. I would love to say this is in every instance. We know it's not, but it definitely, I've never seen it at this level of discussion and dialogue. And by the way, the non-disclosure point I made before, they don't care. They don't care if they've signed anything. They want to look at everything, and they want them to speak. And so it goes back to the earlier question of creating the safe space so that they can come forward.
Next question. Yeah.
I'm Talent Capability Director at Skanska in the UK, so I work with Sarah. We're going for a mentoring session later, aren't we? Yeah.
Oh, you are.
Have to be careful, just the two of us. So something struck a chord when you were talking, and it struck a chord between what Ben was saying and what Alison was saying. So when individuals have got power, or they're the boss, you're saying they've got more confidence in feeling they're right. And it then struck me in terms of when you are called to do, in my HR career, I've had to investigate a number of these type of incidents. But what you tend to find is the aggressor, who's usually the boss, which is sadly the case, is very much better at convincing you there wasn't a sexual harassment case than sometimes the person below. And I just wondered if, Alison, from your experience, any advice about how you go about investigating these based on that dynamic, that usually the aggressor is very good at making a case that nothing has happened?
What companies are doing now is they're pulling away from that manager. So if that's the top boss, then you have to pull in the board. You know, if it's at a certain level, what companies are doing are having this open policy that you can go to other managers, and the group accountability that's happening is we're holding each other accountable and bringing somebody in who's impartial. And so in one case, they had to go completely to a different manager. It's the manager's responsibility to bring it forward. They have a no zero tolerance policy. They're saying in one instance, I know you don't want this to go forward, but I now have to bring it forward, and rightly so. And they will do everything to protect the confidence, but it does have to be escalated. And if it's that direct manager, then it has to be escalated with another influencer. Yes. Yeah, I agree. Well, if you
have character and the determination in the investigation as well, whoever they are.
You're right. And that could be some of the training, what to look for. And I don't know if you have anything to add, Ben, on that with terms of confidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very delicate case because, as always with power, is if you deviate or if you go against it, you know, you become stigmatized and you pay the price for it. I mean, there's a big literature on whistleblowers mm-hmm. that shows that actually, you know, I mean, they're the heroes, but it affects their lifetime career. It's mm-hmm. very sad, you know, and they're protected, but, you know, within the means of states, companies, and so on. For me, the answer to your question is being fact-based and involving a third party to have a bit of, you know, like perspective taking on both sides. But it's a delicate matter.
Yeah, that's a really good point because the impartial party doesn't necessarily belong in the company. So while management should have this accountability, this group accountability, that having a third party come in and navigate those waters could be really powerful.
Bring Ben in. I'm teasing.
Yes, in the full throat. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Buffy Price. I'm from Amnesty International. And sort of leading on from the last point, I'm interested in giving power to the people who are raising issues. And I think a lot of what Me Too has done is help people recognise that there is something happening, actually giving them a language to talk about it. I've often been in meetings and you know something's off, but you can't quite define it. And I was wondering if you can recommend resources, sort of language, how people identify what happened. Is it because I was talked over? Is it because I was sidelined? And sort of helping, how do we empower the average person in a meeting to recognise and identify what the issues are? And if you can recommend something then.
Well, it's in terms of how to empower, for so long, and I'm going to kind of go sideways on this, we've been, especially in the gender diversity space, we've been focusing a lot on women do this or, you know, do that, and it's all, we haven't, but many, many organizations have. This, the responsibility is on the employer. It's not necessarily, there's the element of the individual empowering the employee to come forward when it happens, whether it's a man or a woman. But it's also on the employer, I like what they said about seeing the cues and watching for it. But that bystander event intervention is the other element as well. So when you're in a meeting and you're seeing a behavior, call it out. And I know a CEO last week shared in, I won't say the country, but he shared that one thing he did is he always tolerated certain jokes, and it was shared, and he just said, enough, this is not funny, and called it out. Now, it's not about the hero coming in and rescuing, but I think the more, I don't think it's going to happen immediately, the more the company exhibits that they take this serious, they will create a safe space. And in terms of empowering, that's definitely what they need to arm people with, is what do you do when this happens? Our advice is definitely take it directly to that safe space of power that you can share. But the onus should not be on the employee having to provide the burden of proof. It should be on the hearing it, and then the employer takes over and brings in resources. It's not exactly going to your question about the front end. How do you get them to say? I can tell you my personal experience is when I had it happen, and I had it happen, I'm embarrassed to say at least, on the GLC they joke, yeah, that I had it happen a lot when I was younger. And I remember I went to power. And I shared, and what happened is I had a client meeting, and a very important client from another country came over, and this was in the States, and I was 25, I don't know, and I remember he kept moving, following me around the table, like with a chair, and it was all with jokes. It was like, I'm going to sit right next to you, and then the hand on the knee, and that was it, and I got up, and I walked out. And I said, I went to the owner of this business, and I went to my manager, got them in a room. Client was in the room. I said, this is what I'm dealing with right now. He's using humor, but this is horrible, and I don't know how to handle it. And I was told, you're a big girl. Get back in, and you deal with it, and you handle it. And I did, but I was out the door in 2 months because I didn't have my back. So this is huge in creating for companies to create a safe space that people can come forward. And if you do, definitely reach out to somebody you trust to help them help you find more about how you can talk about this as well. But the responsibility should not be on the individual.
No, absolutely.
I thought that was a little heavy, sorry.
No, absolutely, Alison. I mean, not much to add. I think it's important to think about safe channels. You know, what channels do you have that are safe? You know, I know some companies have been using the infamous Telegram application because it, you know, guarantees anonymity. I mean, it's in a way, the problem is shared with whistleblowers, with a lot, you know, with bullying, with a lot of things. But you know, how do you create a safe channel? And I always go back to an important point, and the point I made earlier about, you know, the design of the workplace. How is your workplace designed? Is it designed around safety, around implication of everyone in the workplace to prevent these behaviors? Or is it designed as a kind of a workplace for many reasons? It can be the organizational structure. Mm. It can be, you know, we talk about organizational structure and organizational culture. These two combined together can be, you know, you can put the same people in two different cultures and two different structures, and behaviors and interaction among human beings would be different. That's what the literature tells us.
But the one thing most companies say is, you see something, say something.
And it's a lot having,
if it's, they have to first show that they mean it. Because a lot of times, in the examples before, it's shown in the behavior that they don't. When somebody stays in a firm or corporation organization. And so that takes time to turn this Titanic around. Because it is a massive issue at the moment.
It was more just in that more the compound impact of subtle, hard to define.
Oh.
If you're in a meeting and you didn't seem to get a chance to ask your question in a half an hour meeting, you're not going to complain about it, but that happens every single time.
Yeah, the microaggressions.
And so it's hard, the individual acts are difficult to raise, escalate, deal with, because the did it happen? Was it just me? Was it because another person was speaking out and another opportunity? But that's eroding over time for the confidence.
Oh, absolutely. That will. So the micro messaging is what we talk about. So in one hand, microaggression. It can be simply you're in a meeting and somebody's on the looking at their phone while you're talking. It's a microaggression. It's not something that you would go, okay, this is going to kick you, I'm going to leave. But in the same breath, it diminishes you a little bit. It diminishes how you feel. And we do a lot of that. We have research on it as well. The opposite of microaggression is a microaffirmation. So the way to tackle it is, you know, it could be like a subtle nod. I thought it was fascinating what you said about the smiling. I nod a lot because I want to be supportive, and I had somebody point out to me, oh, you know, that loses power over nodding. I was like, but I like to nod, you know, so take what you want. But we see so much, and so what we often say when that happens is people have to call it out, especially the interrupting. Even though in my role I oversee our Europe operations, I'm often thought that I'm the receptionist. Nothing against the receptionist, not about power, but it's these, I remember being in one leadership where a lot of leaders were coming in this intensive workshop for a day and a half, giving me their coats. And I was like, I don't care. I'll hang up the coat. I have no... And then at the beginning of the workshop, there was one of the men leading it said, oh, I don't want to introduce Allison. It was no big deal. But I remember this guy just going, oh, I gave her my coat. And you know, that I would say that's a microaggression. It can be misperception, but it's usually anchored in bias. So the way to tackle it is be aware where bias is occurring. Bias training is not going to solve the problems,
The way to tackle bias is to focus on those behaviors that create inclusion. So we do bias training, but we would never do it without coupling it with inclusive leadership behaviors, and such as perspective taking, dialogue versus debate, empowerment, accountability, courage, humility, all of this. So I'm sorry, that was a real long answer. Brevity isn't anything, yeah. I hope we've answered that one, yeah.
Do you want to add anything, Ben, about the questions?
No.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I'm from UCL. Okay. Sarah, you mentioned about the two words, dress appropriately, which is also what I have been thinking about the dress code at work. For example, when you look at the powerful women in corporates, especially in East Asia, what I spot is they usually have a more conservative and darker, like more masculine dress code. By masculine, I mean more dark colors, more edges, like not highlighting curves. Like for example, the president of Taiwan, or even a few powerful women in Japan. So I also refer to Benjamin's mention about the concept of self-agency, persuasion, and influence. So if you mean that powerful people pay attention to the emotion of the other side and takes into the perceptions of others. So what I've been thinking is, instead of conducting the perception-taking exercise to the males or the more powerful people, maybe we can take a reverse perception-taking exercise on women. What I mean is, maybe we should understand the fact that some guys actually objectify women, and they usually have more, they found women attractive, but they are easily have that kind of objectification. So in order to lower or eliminate the objectifications, do you think we should encourage girls to dress more masculinely and more conservative?
I'll let Ben answer that.
Thank you, Alison. No, I think it would defeat the purpose. I mean, you know, the whole purpose is that we need to live peacefully together. And one of the points I noted earlier in the discussion is that one of the main risks for me of hashtag Me Too and so on is that it becomes a gender battle. You know, if this becomes a gender battle, mm-hmm. it's about being together rather than against each other. And I think What the literature suggests as well is that traditionally women in powerful position had to blend into the code of masculinity to be accepted, and that's there's a lot of research around perception stereotyping that looks at simple changes in appearance, such as for a woman with hair tied versus and so how they judge as competent. I mean, the bias in automatic thinking are huge, and the evidence is huge. So I think it's about, for me, once you make people aware of it, you hopefully, and for most of the population, you've made a big step forward. So being aware of it is the first way, because you need to be aware, then you can counter and go against your thinking. If you take a kind of like a cognitive behavioral therapy in a way, a metaphor is I am what I think. Therefore, the first stage is to be aware that your thinking might be distorted, and then you can put in place a strategy to change the way you think. But by no means I would say the solution is to just take what could be not even easy, but I would say coward. We're not going to make any step forward by having to just change and in a way go back in time. I think it's about by far doing the opposite and explaining that it's fine. You're also raising a very good question, Michelle, when you talk about cultural differences, because there are a lot of cultural differences, not just in the phenomenon that we've been discussing, but even if I look at the literature of power across culture, power means something very different in different parts of the world. In collectivist culture, in individualist kind of Western cultures, we tend to have power over people. Mm. In more collectivist cultures, power comes with shared responsibilities. If I've got power over someone, it also means that I'm responsible for the outcomes and I need to care for them. There's this interesting distinction in psychology, which is that in the Western world, we tend to think of a group as an aggregation of individuals, but it's first and foremost about the individual. In more collectivist environment, it's the other way around. It's the group is the default unit, and the group is the basis for society. And individuals are, in a way, just a fraction of this bigger group. So you've got this idea of shared vision, shared perspective that is much more ingrained. In fact, the research, literature on perspective taking show that if you're brought up in a more collectivist environment, you're better at the typical perspective existing exercises that are being done by psychologists. So there's importance, the importance to consider cultural differences in this as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some... Well, I have to say, you know, in no way, shape, or form do we recommend that everybody be, you know, like women dress a certain way. There has been decades of, and I'm not speaking about Asia, but just globally, there has been decades of evidence showing that even when women did all the right things to fit in, they still were not advancing. So it's not about fixing the women. It's really about fixing the culture to recognize that difference is good. And in our research, when we looked at what made people feel included was, and what the outcome was, better teamwork and higher innovation was, and this was a global study, we included China and India in Asia from that study. And what we found is that the uniqueness and the belonging has to be balanced out in order for people to be included. So if I highlight, if I say I'm a leader, okay, I don't see difference. It's all the same. I don't see it. Well, that's an illusion, first of all, because we do see difference, and it's not bad to see difference. But if I only focus on what's unique and different about you, I make you quickly feel a little bit like an outsider from the common group. But if I focus on everything that is you have in common with the group, I'm going to make you feel undervalued because I'm not seeing your difference. So it's not about highlighting one or the other. The balance is highlighting both and balancing it out so that, and this is what we saw globally. We found out India was a slight exception when we did this study, but globally, it was that balance that made people feel included. India said it was two sides of the same coin, so we've had to do more research on India to look and see why, and maybe it's our misperception to think, you know, that is surprising. It probably shouldn't be. It's India is so diverse as is, you know, other countries. But with leaders, it's so important that we not expect people to be like a dominant certain style, because what you have at the top is what you'll get unless you consciously disrupt that default. So in terms of clothing, we had this, I was smiling because we had this big discussion about clothing and power beforehand. I won't go into the debate, but it's very real what you're experiencing and sharing. I just want to acknowledge that because we see that too. And so within the confines of the culture, it's really important for a company culture to highlight. In our culture, we might be in another culture, but our culture, here's what we think. And what you're also just highlighting are unwritten rules. And we learn them by having access to certain networks and find out, are they real or are they not? And many times they are. Unwritten rule that I see across Europe, not as much as I did 5 years ago, that I hear all over is don't smile so much. Yeah, I know. I fortunately have not heard it in this last year at all, so let's hope this one is dying. But I hear it all over, that it compromises your sense of gravitas. And if you know what gravitas means, is gravitas comes from Latin, to speak with weight, gravity. And yet, somehow, we've taken this word and made it a very masculine word and masculine behaviors. So there's a lot of bias in some of the recommendations and unwritten rules that are alive and well in companies. And gravitas is one of them. And it's in the Netherlands, I'll say this really quick, one leader, I asked him, what does gravitas mean to you? And he said, Darth Vader. How many women sound like Darth Vader? How many? So you can see how bias can seep in these unwritten rules.
That's great. I think we've got time for one or possibly two more questions, so I could perhaps collect them so that we manage to finish up. So come on, I'm sure you've got other things you want to ask. Yes, Lucy.
Hi. What struck me about what we were talking about today is what Alison said is when power is shared across gender, harassment goes down. But what we tend to find is that women in kind of senior levels of power tend to attract negative stereotypes. So what advice would you give to women to kind of counteract that?
Well, we hear this a lot, and there's like a cottage industry built around that. You know, women are this way when they get into senior leaders, leadership role. And I think what we found is that the queen bee myth, that they're not supportive, or that it's not true. According to our global research, we find that women are developing other women, approximately, I think it's 72%, versus men developing women is about 30%. And so this could highlight a difference in some ways of how power is shared, is we need more men also, you know, developing women as well, not being afraid to have that. But it is a myth we see, and while we can all have our personal experiences, let's celebrate the fact that women are supporting women. And I do think because there are so few women at the top, they're held under the microscope a lot more. And so some things are showing up maybe more evidently. I don't know.
Yeah, I think also, sadly, it's... you know, there needs to be cultural changes, and as more women come to prominent position, you know, it will gradually shift the focus on them being a minority from them being the norm. You can look, you know, into countries in which, for instance, there are a few countries in the world where you've got more women MP, members of parliament than men. For instance, I think Norway is one of them. Scandinavian countries, generally speaking, are much ahead on these. And I would say time and cultural change is what will help. It's difficult, you know. In the meantime, it's difficult to swim against the stream. So, you know, it's difficult to say exactly what can work and cannot work. It really depends on the company and so on. But generally speaking, mentoring and getting support and getting reinforced in the idea that, you know, what you're doing is right, the way you know, there's nothing wrong there, and getting this heard by other people, you know, is important, because the business world, you know, and the working life is a tough world. I mean, you know, it is being a man, being a woman, being transgender, being, you know, it is a difficult world. And so the positive thing that result from all of this is that there's more attention and hopefully people get more support. I have to say as well, I felt that the LSE does a good job at training their staff on that. I mean, I did the discrimination training and the online training and so on, and I thought they're good, you know, little role plays where you have to understand and step into the shoes. And the more we use this, the more. And I've got bigger hopes. I was saying this at the end of my lecture, but what virtual reality can really bring is there's nothing like experiencing it firsthand. if you can see what it's like to be harassed from the eyes, you know, I mean, I also do a lot of research around what we call first-person perspective and third-person perspective. Mm-hmm. And I work with a neuropsychologist at the LSE who's one of my co-authors on some of these. And the brain does not react the same way when you look at a situation from the perspective of an outsider or from the perspective of the person experiencing the phenomenon. And I think the more we can be exposed to first-person experience of harassment, of discrimination, of bullying, the more it can be a game changer.
Thank you. Well, it's been a great pleasure for me, and I'm sure for everybody, to listen to your wonderful insights this afternoon. So thank you so much. I'm sure you're both incredibly busy people, so we're so glad that you found time in your schedule to come and speak to us this afternoon. And so I just ask you all at the end to thank our wonderful speakers. Thank you. Thank you.